Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 15th, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Pause, Atomidate, and the Rapid Sequence Intubation in Sepsis. And this week, we have another member of the Beam Dream Team, Dr. Sunil Upadhyay. Sunil, say hello to the SGEM audience.
Hello, SGEM audience, and thanks for having me here today, Ken.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Can you please tell us a little bit about your qualifications to be on the Skeptic's Guide today?
Certainly. I am currently appointed at McMaster University as an Associate Clinical Professor of Emergency Medicine. I'm also an Associate Member of the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics at McMaster University. I'm an instructor and tutor in the Systematic Reviews and Meta-Analysis Graduate Course in the Health Research Methodology Program here at McMaster under the tutelage of Gord Guyatt and Deb Cook, two of the preeminent meta-analysts in medical history. This is actually important since we are talking about a meta-analysis paper today. Finally, with respect to sepsis, I have a couple of publications in terms of review articles in the Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2009, dealing with the MedScore to risk stratify patients, with Captain Cranium Chris Carpenter, one of our Beam co-founders. And I also have a review article in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2007 about critical care response teams dealing with septic patients involving emergency physicians.
Sunil, I can see why you're part of the Beam Dream Team and highly qualified to talk about sepsis today. We like to start each podcast with a case scenario, so I'm going to read out this case scenario so you know what we're dealing with. In this case, it's a 70-year-old man who arrives via ambulance from home, complaining of being weak and dizzy, our favorite presentation. He has no specific complaints of chest pain, shortness of breath, abdominal pain, or focal weakness. He's just weak and dizzy. He has a history of hypertension, benign prostatic hypertrophy, dyslipidemia, and osteoarthritis. His vital signs are: his blood pressure is 76 over 48. He's tachycardic at 110, and his O2 sat is 86%. His temperature is taken, and he's found to be febrile at 39.5 degrees Celsius. He's difficult to rouse, and you decide that he needs rapid sequence intubation. So the question for today's SGEM podcast is, can you use Atomidate for rapid sequence intubation in septic patients? Now, Sunil, before we go further, I thought we probably should bring everybody up to speed on sepsis itself, because it seems to have received a lot more attention over the last decade or so. And this includes both the Surviving Sepsis campaign and the Early Goal-Directed Therapy. Both ASEP and CAPE, that's the American College of Emergency Physicians, and the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians, have guidelines that address the optimal management of severe sepsis. So can you give us a definition of sepsis, Sunil?
Sure, Ken. The current operating definition for sepsis is as follows. Quote, sepsis is defined as the presence of both systemic inflammatory response syndrome and a suspicion of infection. Sepsis is a syndrome and can range from relatively mild, simple infection to severe, including septic shock and multi-organ dysfunction. Morbidity and mortality increase if a patient deteriorates from sepsis to severe sepsis to septic shock and multi-organ dysfunction. And this is as per the CAPE guideline that was initially published in 2008.
Okay, why don't we just briefly go through those key aspects of the CAPE guideline from 2008 then. And they came out with a number of points and they gave grade recommendations. And I guess the very first thing anybody has to do when it comes to sepsis is ding, 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 recognize that somebody's septic to begin with. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. There's a lot of evidence out there suggesting that in emergency populations, at least, there seems to be less than 20% agreement on recognition of septic patients. So if you can't find them, you're not going to resuscitate them and save their lives.
So I guess identification or early recognition of sepsis is key. But once we've recognized it, let's go through briefly some of the therapeutic maneuvers that can be done. And these grades are from A to D, I believe, right? A, B, C, and D?
In the Canadian scheme from 2008, it is an A to D grade.
Now, there's a new grading system, right?
There's a number of grading systems, actually, Ken, and that's one of the pitfalls of clinical practice guidelines. The original ASAP guidelines in 2006 used the guideline system that ASAP has been using since 1993, created by David Schrager, and still used by the current ASAP Clinical Policy Committee. It's a little old and archaic and not intuitive for readers, period. The CAPE guidelines used the Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine strata, which is an ABCD system, suggesting that grade A recommendations are strong, with lots of evidence supporting the recommendation, and less so as you move through grade B, C, and D, which may in fact have evidence against the intervention in question. Finally, the newest system available in the last few years, created out of McMaster and globally endorsed, is the actual grade system itself, G-R-A-D-E, and that's been picked up by many, many international journals around the world now and is becoming the standard prototype. Furthermore, the grade system is the system that's been used in the 2013 update of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines published in December of 2012.
Okay, since we have the 2008 CAPE guidelines and they haven't been updated and they're still using that older grading system, let's quickly run through that, okay? And I'll get your expert opinion on each one of these maneuvers. The first one is intravenous fluids, IV fluids, grade B. What do you think?
I think it's an intuitively obvious recognition that if a patient is in shock, you have to do fluid resuscitation. That's not just in sepsis. That's in all of the emergency critical care patients we see. So a high-grade recommendation to give intravenous fluid resuscitation is obvious.
Now, intubation, we're talking about intubating this gentleman, and it's a grade D recommendation.
Again, intuitive to most emergency physicians is that if the patient is failing to protect their airway, they're having difficulties with oxygenating their end organs, taking over the work of breathing with definitive airway management and ventilatory support is critical. Furthermore, there's evidence out there suggesting that the work of breathing alone in the critical care literature is almost 30 to 35% of the cardiac output, if not more, and taking away this critical work makes it easier for the body to fight off the infectious insult that it's dealing with.
How about doing central venous pressure monitoring? That's a grade D as well.
There's evidence suggesting that CVP monitoring is a useful surrogate for intravascular volume resuscitation. You have to be careful using CVP monitors, though, in intubated patients who are under positive pressure, because there's going to be an inherently higher intrathoracic pressure that will falsely elevate the CVP reading, which is why in the recommendations of having a CVP of 8 to 12 millimeters of mercury, you want to lean to the higher side in a patient who has been intubated and is on positive pressure ventilation.
Well, since we're talking about pressure, how about vasopressors? They're a grade B recommendation. Any comments on those?
Yeah, there's actually some pretty good reviews in the last couple of years, both in Cochrane and the print journal literature, suggesting that there are certain vasopressors that are more advantageous than others. The bottom line with most of these is that norepinephrine is the superior choice for vasopressor support in fluid resuscitated septic shock patients. Bottom line really is use any drug except for dopamine. That's a controversy we can talk about later.
Sure. How about ionotropes? They're a grade D recommendation.
From what I recall, there's very little evidence supporting ionotropes in terms of any choices. Most likely in the ER setting, we're not going to get to that point anyway. And the original inotrope that they used in early goal-directed therapy 2001 in the Rivers protocol was dobutamine. Again, if you get to that point, you're probably asking for a critical care consultation and ready to tap out at that point.
All right, how about lactate levels? This has gotten more attention lately, and lactate levels are a level B recommendation.
And rightfully so. Lactate is probably the dominant marker of grading the severity of the initial infection and also for following successful resuscitation from an anaerobic state, which generates lactic acidosis, to back to an aerobic state. The original article by Bryant Nguyen in Critical Care Medicine 2004, which was a substudy of early goal-directed therapy master trial, showed that if you resuscitated patients with a lactate reduction of greater than 10% in the first 6 hours, that translated to a significant and sustained mortality benefit.
How about drawing cultures in the emergency department? It gets a grade D recommendation. Why do you think that is, Sunil?
Likely because most emergency physicians aren't going to be getting the results back in real time to influence antibiotic choices. this is more likely a result that'll be useful for Dr. Somebody Else at a different time.
Well, that brings up the broad spectrum antibiotics. Curious, it's only a grade C recommendation.
Likely a grade C recommendation because the likelihood that you're going to see randomized control trials looking at antibiotic timing and or whether or not patients get antibiotics at all in a septic situation will never happen. It would be unethical to do such studies. And it's just intuitive that when somebody has a septic presentation, giving them broad spectrum antibiotics is absolutely necessary. And there is observational research suggesting that delayed antibiotics or inappropriate antibiotics do lead to increased mortality.
I guess that's one of the limits of evidence-based medicine because you really can't randomize people into antibiotic late group for sepsis or the placebo arm.
Never going to happen.
Okay, so how about steroids? That's a level D.
Yeah, there's a controversy about steroids that the notion was that if the patients have potential adrenal insufficiency and you've given them fluids and vasopressors, the next step would be to give them steroids. This is more likely better achieved in a critical care environment. It's rarely undertaken, I would suggest, in an emergency department. And there's sparse evidence suggesting that low bolus steroid infusions, rather than high dose or high bolus dosing up front, is the safest way to do this. This was highlighted in a JAMA systematic review a couple of years ago by Jalili Anand and his research group.
Blood transfusions are a level B recommendation, one of the highest recommendations in this guideline.
The notion around blood transfusions is, again, intuitive. If you have given so much crystalloid to the patient that you're worried about a dilutional anemia, remember the goal is to carry oxygen back to the tissues that are in anaerobic states and creating lactic acidosis. Therefore, if the carrying capacity has been diluted less to a hematocrit of 0.3, according to most bundle guidelines, you have to give them blood to give them oxygen back.
And I put at the bottom of the list two things that have actually, I think, come off the list of recommendations, and that is active protein C and glucose control. Both of those were grade D in the 2008 CAPE guidelines.
Agreed, Ken. And it has now turned out that activated protein C has been removed from the market after an abundance of evidence has shown almost little to no benefit, and Eli Lilly has taken it off the market. With regards to glucose control, there are certainly trials and systematic reviews, the most recent one, for, again, in JAMA, suggesting that tight glycemic control in critically ill patients cause more harm than it does good, likely because of more episodes of hypoglycemia.
Let's talk about the paper. Which one did you pick for today's podcast, Sunil?
I picked the paper, Ken, that focuses, again, on the critical question that we're looking at, which is the safety of etomidate in rapid sequence intubation of patients with severe sepsis or septic shock. The actual title is etomidate is associated with mortality and adrenal insufficiency in sepsis, a meta-analysis. This paper was published by Chiman Chan and his research group and in the journal Critical Care Medicine 2012.
So the PICO, the population intervention comparison and outcome, was as follows. The population was septic patients requiring mechanical ventilation, not pediatric patients, just adults. The intervention was one single dose of etomidate for a rapid sequence intubation. The comparison was other various sedative agents, and the outcome was mortality, all cause, or at 28 days, and adrenal insufficiency. So that's the PICO. Sunil, can you take us through the major results of this paper?
Sure. If I can make a quick comment of the methodology, this was a well-conducted meta-analysis with an unrestricted search that was comprehensive, good quality assessments, low heterogeneity between the studies included, and there was no evidence of publication bias. With regards to the results themselves, if you're going to follow on the blog, the forest plots, you can follow along there, and I will outline the results here. There were five studies that looked at mortality outcomes involving 867 patients. Overall, there was an increased risk of all-cause death with etomidate, with a relative risk of 1.2 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 through 1.42, and very low evidence of heterogeneity with an I-squared value of 4.9%. There was no difference in subgroup analyses when they looked at randomized control trials only, or with the standardized mortality at 28 days. The 95% confidence intervals in the all-cause and the subgroup mortality analyses are rather wide, however. So you have to take the precision of these estimates with a bit of a grain of salt. Now, with the adrenal insufficiency outcome, there were 7 studies that included 1,303 patients. Again, there was an increased risk of adrenal insufficiency demonstrated with Etomidate, this time with a relative risk of 1.33, and a much more significant confidence interval of 1.22 to 1.46, although heterogeneity here demonstrated statistical heterogeneity with an I-squared value of 43.9%. Again, there was no difference in the adrenal insufficiency outcome when a sensitivity analysis was conducted using randomized controlled trials only.
Well, I can see how septic patients might be worried about, you know, mortality outcomes as a very patient-oriented outcome, but I'm not so sure that they'd be really jazzed about adrenal insufficiency. What do you think?
I would agree. A very well-done systematic review on the same topic, a Canadian researcher, Dr. Corinne Hole, and her group in Vancouver, published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2010, demonstrated that from a timing point of view, the duration of adrenal insufficiency seems to be less than 24 hours and is clinically insignificant.
All right, so the author's conclusion were, quote, administration of Etomidate for rapid sequence intubation is associated with higher rates of adrenal insufficiency and mortality in patients with sepsis. Well, it's time to turn to the Beam Dream team expert, and that's you, Sunil. Can you give us some commentary on this paper you picked?
Sure. We picked this paper because it was controversial, and its outcome is based on a flawed methodology with regards to the meta-analysis. The new review actually raises concerns about the safety of Etomidate in septic RSI, as it's the first review that focuses on mortality issues rather than prior studies that looked at mostly adrenal insufficiency only. The problem with this paper, though, is that the conclusions for mortality risk have to be qualified because the biggest study driving the mortality outcome is a positive observational substudy of the Corticus randomized control trial that was published by Cuthbertson et al. That included 499 patients. And this substudy contributed 37% to almost 56% of the patients that were pooled in the various meta-analysis subgroups for this study. For those people who are looking on the blog, if you look at forest plots, you can see that this is the only positive study that's suggesting harm in all of the different forest plots without the confidence interval crossing the line of no difference. And the other included studies show no significant difference statistically. It's also clear that excluding the Cuthbertson data, if you took that study actually out, the rest of the pooled data would probably suggest that there is no statistically significant difference in mortality whether you use Etomidate at all. There have been other criticisms of the Cuthbertson cohort of patients suggesting that they were sicker in that substudy, they were more likely to be intubated, and that group had a higher SAPS2 score, a SAP score of 2, which is a marker of severity of illness in critical care, and that group had a hospital mortality of almost 50%. So it's not really clear why the Cuthbertson results are an outlier compared to the other substudies and randomized trials that were included in this systematic review. And the results of pooling would certainly not be robust in terms of the final answer that Etomidate is dangerous if this study were actually removed. So the authors don't address why the Cuthbertson study's results seem to be so different from all the other included studies. There was that systematic review published 2 years ago that I referred to by Corinne Hole's group. It was more conservative. It was methodologically much more sound as a meta-analysis than this one was. And this one rightly excluded the Cuthbertson observational study from the randomized trial systematic review meta-analysis that they conducted. And their result was that there was no increased mortality from Etomidate bolus use in rapid sequence intubation in septic shock patients.
But let's get down to the Beam bottom line. And the Beam bottom line from this paper was that the review updates the controversy, because it is controversial, on the using a single dose of Etomidate for rapid sequence intubation in septic patient. And it raises more concerns about increased in-hospital mortality.
I would agree, Ken, but remember, however, this is still based on a single large observational substudy of a failed randomized controlled trial, which is methodologically a very risky thing to do in a systematic review and meta-analysis, and it's not clear why these trial results were so different from the others, so they should not have been included in this final result.
So that's where we got the theme for today's podcast, at least the music, that this is enough information to give us pause to routine use of etomidate in septic patients, but not to abandon it completely.
I would agree, Ken.
So how are you going to resolve this case that we came up with of the 70-year-old man who presented with sepsis and we recognized it early?
Well, this is a common presentation amongst the frail elderly in our institution, as well as many institutions across North America and the world, I'm sure. We would certainly initiate fluid resuscitation with crystalloids. I would certainly do a rapid sequence intubation, and I'm very comfortable with using etomidate in this patient. I would draw the appropriate laboratory tests, including blood cultures, urine cultures, lactate levels, and so on. I would start broad-spectrum antibiotics towards the source of infection that I suspected. And finally, I would call for expert critical care help and facilitate transfer to definitive care, which is also supported by the evidence.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sunil. Well, that brings us close to the end of the podcast. Last week's Keener Contest winner was Joseph Merriweather from Melrose Park, Illinois. And apparently that's about 10 minutes outside of Chicago. He gave me the 5 reasons for elevated troponins besides acute myocardial infarction, which included pulmonary embolism, congestive heart failure, myocarditis, pericarditis, and blunt trauma. Congratulations, Joseph, and I will be sending you a cool skeptical prize. So the Keener contest for this week is Define SIRS, Systemic Inflammatory Response Syndrome. If you know the answer, send it to thesgem@gmail.com. Be the first one to correctly answer it, and I will send you a cool skeptical prize. Now follow the SGM on Twitter, and of course we always like getting more likes on Facebook. And Sunil, as the guest, do you think you could give the SGM tagline?
I'd love to, Ken. Again, thanks to you and the SGM listeners for giving me this opportunity to join. And I would advise all the listeners of the SGM and followers of the Facebook page and the blog to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it here on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Excellent. Talk to everyone next week. Talk.